Welcome, welcome, welcome into Redacted on this Monday. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
And on this show, we cut through the propaganda, cover the stories the mainstream media largely ignores. We're also one of the largest anti-war shows in the world on social media. I was at the Roger Waters show on Friday night in Lisbon, Portugal, and a lot of Redacted viewers were there and said, I think we're all on the same page, anti-war, anti-war. So hello to all of our Redacted anti-war fans.
That's very exciting.
It was exciting. So we are going to talk some anti-war because of Xi Jinping of China just landed in Moscow just a few short hours ago, and they have a three-day agenda, one of which is peace. But that's not flying too well with the United States, who actively does not want peace. In fact, on Sunday, speaking out against peace in Ukraine. So we'll talk about that. Plus, it's all kind of tied together with President Trump about to be arrested for for a campaign contribution issue. So we'll see what happens there. So it's really the tale of two continents right now, I guess.
Yeah.
So we'll see about that.
It very much feels like East versus West. And you see the West at the center of, feels like it, of course. Of course, America thinks it's the center of the universe. But what happens there is what sort of reverberates around the world. And so that's why we're watching this, not because we actually think the West is the center of the world. We also are going to get a progress report on the war from Colonel McGregor. And we are going to talk about the Twitter files that dropped over the weekend and how they continue to prove how the conversation around COVID was not only censored, but an amazing power grab for the government to reach inside of social media and dictate the terms of conversation. We know it. We continue to know it more, so we're going to go over that. All that and more as Redacted starts right now.
Welcome, everybody. Good to see everybody on this Monday. You know, we have a limited time t-shirt right now at redactedstore.com, which is silence equals complicity. Like, if you stay silent when the face of wars right now, we are just as complicit as those carrying it out. And that was actually a big message. It was actually kind of exciting. On Friday night, there's our shirt, silence equals complicity. You can find that at redactedstore.com. There it is. And a lot of people have already ordered this shirt, but a bunch of people at the Roger Waters concert, this was a lot of the message.
Yeah.
Like, anti-war, vehemently anti-war, right? And we need to stand up and speak out against these wars. And it was great to see Redacted viewers there who have, you know, believe in that message and understand that message. Like, if you don't agree on politics and other things with Roger and others, that's fine. If we can all get together and we do not want nuclear war, like, that should be the thing that can unite all of us. Like, how can
right.
we disagree, you know?
And critical thought is a main part of his message and those albums that runs throughout is don't swallow the things that government power and authoritarianism want to shove down your throat, but think for yourself, read for yourself, research for yourself. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, who other than, like, you know, a 14-year-old edgelord wants nuclear war? Like,
we're gonna see.
Yeah, the only people I ever like actually see like, oh no, I would love it if that happened, are like the people that are just they're edgelords, you know. They just want to live on that edge and be fringe.
Well, the talking point of the United States over the weekend is that peace is unacceptable at this point. We're going to break down how in the world anyone can ever say this. Politics has jumped the shark at this point if it's literally that peace is unacceptable. So we're going to get to that. Maybe you did a little homework and read your newsletter. You don't have to, but this is something that we provide for you as a daily study guide and informative piece of information. Comes daily to your news, to your email. If you put in your email address and submit, it's free. It's a free subscription. You just sign up and we write you a little bit of news that is supposed to be like a companion piece to this show. Comes every day. You just have to authenticate that email so that it doesn't get sent to spam. It's got a lot of the same stories that we talk about here, plus more, a little bit more. For instance, today is the first day of spring, so I'd like to wish all of you a brand new start to a brand new season. And hopefully we can continue to encourage each other and be positive here, because the news doesn't seem positive. Clayton and I were talking about how, This all seems like it's heavy this week, but let's stick together. If we didn't have you, I don't know what. I don't know what I would do. Clayton and I would just look at each other like, what world are we raising our children in? But we have each other. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, someone wrote to me today and said, I mean, how do you navigate all this craziness? And I think you just need to really just, you know, be close with your family, do the things that mean the most to you in your life right now, and just and speak out against this craziness. So I should mention our newsletter. The URL is redacted.inc. That's the place to go. Redacted.inc is the newsletter, is the URL.
I just put these on and then I realize they're dirty. This happens every day.
I know, every day at the beginning of the show. If you're watching the beginning of the show, you can always see Natalie grab the cloth.
I put on these and then I'm like, oh, that's not going to work. And then I grab my microfiber. I'm ready. I can see the information. Okay. I'm ready to go.
All right. I just don't want everyone, like, the top story every day, they see like a big ugly pink cloth in the start of our show. Like, as the start.
How about I just put it right here?
No. If you're listening to the audio version of this is really
careful.
Terrible.
You're
terrible.
You're gonna end up with another water bottle issue. So
yeah, this is terrible television. All right, let's get to it. We are watching the unipolar order crumbling before our eyes. The U.S. could be on the verge of civil war with the impending arrest of Donald Trump. Europe is facing an energy crisis, the banking crisis, while President Xi Jinping of China just landed in Moscow just a few hours ago to solidify this massive new partnership that really could change everything, really could undermine the unipolar order. And that's really what they're already talking about, is the idea that, no, we need a multipolar order. We need to have this relationship that is just beyond the West controlling everything. And I think what we're about to see in Russia could alter the course of human history for the next 100 to perhaps 200 years. I know, I mean, that's a bold prediction, but that is exactly how it's shaping up right now. President Biden started off his presidency with a big goal, right? That big goal was to drive a giant wedge salad in between Russia and China. Instead, he's actually done the opposite. He's managed to do the unthinkable in many ways, which is really solidify this partnership. You know, Russia was operating on its own. They had an agreement since early 2000, which was great, and it came together, this Asia Russia pact. That was great. But Biden has actually brought them together in a way that we haven't seen before. He's actually done the opposite.
By giving them a common enemy, which is the expansion of NATO.
Right.
And also providing the world with a really clear decision between hegemony based on military might and hegemony based on financial might.
Yeah.
And so now the world that is caught in the crosshairs is going to decide, do we sort of follow the market-based order of Russia and China, or do we continue to follow the military order of the United States?
Well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and also think of like what's the best recruiting tool. Like the fact that we do the things that we do has been a recruiting tool for all of these other countries with their organizations and stuff, just to fight what we do around the world. So the BRICS nations are going to be like, yeah, we're on board, like whatever you're going to do.
Yeah.
And you're seeing this video already. I mean, China and Russia, I mean, you're already seeing like Xi Jinping walking around getting a tour, right? They're all like shaking hands, and they're going to meet tomorrow more deeply about this. But right now, the relationships between China and Russia are the best we've ever seen. Just to give you an example of the love fest, Putin wrote an article on Sunday praising the relationship with China and Xi Jinping. That article was published in China's main newspaper. And she then wrote an equally effusive piece about Putin that was published in Russian newspapers. Just think about that for a second. Both articles talk about how much they like working with one another, how relations between the two countries are the best that they've ever been. Just for a minute, could you imagine, just imagine the king of Saudi Arabia, right, writing a love letter like that before Biden visits Riyadh? Could you imagine that happening?
No, but I can imagine it if we're going to make love buddies. Trudeau and Biden would do that for each other.
I don't even, well, perhaps. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, that makes more sense. Perhaps. I don't know, but I even think they wouldn't even really do this back and forth, like write a letter like this.
Rishi Sunak, you saw him, doing a conference call with Justin Trudeau. Those two are
maybe those
our
two
besties.
Maybe Zelensky. Maybe Zelensky and President Biden
would
do that.
Well, we saw that in advance of Zelensky's speeches to Congress.
But they both write a letter that gets published in the opposing country's newspapers, like effusive, like, we're really excited. This is the
we
best our relationship has ever been. Like, okay. I mean, I just can't picture that. It's unbelievable. Also worth noting that both articles written by both men talk about Ukraine. And they talk about how they're both open to peace there. She, in his, said he sees a path to peace. And Putin says he's been pushing for peace. Imagine how pissed the U.S. would be if China actually manages to negotiate a peace agreement between Ukraine and Russia.
Imagine. Which is something the United States absolutely could do, but refuses to.
Well, they're the one. Yeah, they absolutely could. They could have not started this war to begin with, the United States, and provoking Russia into this. This would piss the hell out of NATO, though, if China does this and manages to broker a peace agreement with Ukraine. But of course, the United States and NATO doesn't want that because they want to use Ukraine as a proxy for years to come, for many, many decades to come. Even John Kirby this weekend, National Security Advisor to President Biden, said, we're not open to any kind of ceasefire in Ukraine. We're not open to it. We all want every Ukrainian to be dead before we start talking about peace. That's basically what he said. Watch.
Hey, that if coming out of this meeting, there's some sort of call for a ceasefire, well, that's just going to be unacceptable because all that's going to do, Mike, is ratify Russia's conquest to date. All that's going to do is give Mr. Putin more time to refit, retrain, reman, and try to plan for renewed offensives at a time of his choosing. We hope, and we've said this before, that President Xi will call and talk to President Zelensky because we believe the Chinese need to get the Ukrainian perspective here. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, President Putin did actually visit Crimea, and he visited the Donbas over the weekend. And the Western press continues to tell you that these are seized areas, forgetting the fact that there was a referendum vote, and those people did, in fact, vote to become a part of Russia. But, you know, the line here is we can't just let them keep them. We must fight until those places become reintegrated into Ukraine when there's no military mission in order to do that.
You're absolutely right, because I mean, it was hilarious to read the press headlines. So President Putin went to Mariupol, which was destroyed, and then Russia came in, and by the way, largely destroyed by Ukrainian shelling of this area. Russia came in and basically rebuilt it. And in fact, now just built, I think it was an opera house or something, but all the apartment complexes, like allowing people to move back into these apartment complexes, they rebuilt the infrastructure there. You know, it's not ideal, right, that they had their homes destroyed. But of course, this was the move by Russia to come in and solidify this area. But the Western media coverage is Putin visits occupied Mariupol. It's occupied. No, those people voted to become part of Russia.
Who cares what they want?
Who destroyed the apartments and houses?
Exactly.
That's important.
Right. Ukraine did. Yeah. Right. So and they've been doing that for years. I mean, there's been a genocide unfolding in this area for the last 9 years. But forget about that.
Those people, you know, you like that. You like being bombed. And you don't know what's best for you when you go to the polls.
So even Putin addressed that this weekend in Mariupol. He was interviewed by a reporter and the reporter asked him, you know, like, why didn't you? It was a pretty good question. He's like, Why didn't you start the special military operation in 2014 after the West basically kept continuing to bomb the Donbas? And he's like, we were actually led by the nose on this. He's like, we were basically fooled by them. We thought that they would end these attacks, and we didn't want to have to do this, but we thought that they would adhere to the Minsk agreements, and we kept giving them an opportunity to do so. They didn't, and in the end, this is what we had to do. He's like, we should have done this earlier. Yeah. So it's kind of a crazy admission, but he's like, we were led by the nose on this. We were lied to, basically. Here's how the Wall Street Journal paints it. American press coverage of this is also pretty hilarious. U.S. seeks to head off any Chinese call for ceasefire in Ukraine, reads the Wall Street Journal.
Now, what is that image trying to tell us here? Like, we want that to continue.
Right. So this poor old woman who, whatever situation is going on here, U.S. seeks to head off any Chinese call for a ceasefire.
Like, she's got to keep living that way.
But I'm shocked they don't have a little red arrow pointing that fire saying Russia did this.
Right.
It is amazing. But I just want to read. Let me read a paragraph or two from this Wall Street Journal piece. I'm quoting now. The preemptive criticism of a possible ceasefire proposal is a broadening of a Biden administration effort to use public statements and disclosures to try to narrow Beijing's room for maneuver with Moscow, including by projecting itself as a mediator, according to former officials and foreign affairs analysts. But here's my favorite paragraph. In recent weeks, U.S. officials citing intelligence have publicly warned that Beijing is considering providing lethal weapons and capabilities to Russia, going beyond trade in goods like drones and jet parts that have both civilian and military uses. Mr. Kirby reiterated that concern, though he said the U.S. has no evidence China has done so.
No evidence, you say? That's so damning.
So we're saying that China is providing weapons to Russia ahead of the ceasefire talk, and yet we have no evidence that they're doing that. So why print it? Like, why print this in an American newspaper?
Well, we've seen John Kirby say before, what's your evidence for that? And he's literally said, I'm saying it out loud. That's what the evidence is. That was about the disinformation campaign that he said Russia was about to launch.
Right.
We saw that when an AP reporter pushed back on him just last year. And they said, what's your evidence? And he's like, me saying it. So that counts in this day and age.
Yeah, me saying it, that's our evidence. Oh, I'm just a stenographer like I was in, you know, like all the reporters were during the Obama years. Oh, whatever you say, I'll just write it down and print it in a newspaper.
Yes.
That's propaganda. And what we try to do is cut through the propaganda here on this show. So what about this summit? It's a very important summit. Xi Jinping and Putin are going to sign at least 12 incredibly important documents, which we won't know the full details of for a few days. They're there doing this for like 3 days. That they need to be negotiated. So the meeting notes we've been hearing, it's going to be all about negotiation, negotiation, negotiation. That's what they said 3 times, negotiation. They're going to negotiate new energy policy, oil, natural gas agreements, manufacturing and trade. And those meetings will take place, the bulk of them will take place on Tuesday, so tomorrow. 3 days of intense meetings to iron out the new world order, essentially. A few headlines to show you now about how the power dynamic is already shifting from a U.S. dollar back-end world reserve currency to a new BRICS-centric currency. Yeah, this over the past few days, China oil. China to import record amounts of Russian oil in defiance of U.S.-led sanctions. So China's just ramping up its oil imports. Here's another one. This weekend, when Western banks were collapsing, you know, UBS buying Credit Suisse, Putin issued a statement. Russia has survived the loss of these Western bank markets. Western Europeans are now grappling with problems they had predicted for Russia, according to the president. The Russian economy is developing in a new way, with GDP expected to grow as the second quarter of this year, Putin said on Thursday. Okay. So while the West is dealing with all of the craziness of fake money and money printing, according to them, they say their GDP will continue to grow, I guess, but we'll have to rely on Russian numbers. Putin's saying that, so maybe we won't know, but okay, that's what he's saying.
But think about who's watching for this. The United States is watching in kind of a jealous way, but there are other countries, other nations whose economies have suffered, for instance, Argentina, who are saying if they can do this, if they can solidify a new hegemonic currency, we're in. Argentina has already said that they would like to join BRICS nation. Think about Mexico with the suffering economy. Think about all.
Well, Mexico announced a week ago that they're ready to go to BRICS.
Yes.
So
there was an African nation that, I'm sorry, it eludes me at this point. So there are many countries that are resource rich that are ready and are watching. So it's not just, we're covering this because we are American citizens from the eye of like, what's this gonna do to this central of power? But think about the onlookers who are now, they have a currency that's based on the US dollar that they want to change.
Well, Algeria, you mentioned African, there's a bunch of African nations actually that are ready to go.
Yes.
And Putin has said—
Somalia, I believe, was one of them.
We welcome them. Algeria, Somalia,
Sudan,
Namibia.
We talked about last week.
There's a number of African nations right now that are ready to go.
This is the old bully on the playground story coming to fruition, because it's like all these other countries have been so scared to stand up to the bully, which is the United States. And finally, there's someone that's going to punch us in the nose and knock us down a few pegs. And once these countries see that that's possible, they're going to get in line with them, because it makes more sense to be aligned with them. They're not going to— maybe they will eventually, but they're not sanctioning them. They're not going and overthrowing their governments, all the stuff we do.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, Marty, it's like George McFly finally punching Biff in the face, you know?
Exactly.
Like, get your damn hands off of her.
Right.
You know, it's like,
and it changes
finally,
history.
Finally. It is our density.
So Russia and China, and here's another one. There's two more headlines I want to show you. Russia and China trade on pace to hit $200 billion this year. Economic cooperation between the two nations has strengthening amid outside pressure. $200 billion, a new record. And this, here's China dumping American debt, according to U.S. Treasury data. So this is from the U.S. Treasury last week, and they released this on Wednesday of last week. The figures show that China has been dumping U.S. Treasuries because, well, guess what happens? If the United States freezes assets, then those U.S. Treasuries they bought are frozen. So China's like, well, these things are starting to become worthless anyway, so why don't we dump them? And they've been doing that in a huge, this is the biggest dumping yet of U.S. Treasuries, moving away from that towards their own, to their own BRICS currency backing. Pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll keep our eye on this summit again over the next few days. We just had word just a few minutes ago, actually, that they issued like a joint statement saying that the United States is the common threat to both Russia and China's sovereignty.
Right. And we're going to hear the words a lot, NATO aggression.
Right.
That they, how are they considering moving against NATO aggression? And again, it's not just this centralized area, but it's all member of countries in South America, in Central America, that want the same, that just want to be sovereign and not controlled by NATO goals.
And their message, of course, coming out of the summit is multipolar, right? That every country should have the right to their own sovereignty, right? Not this unipolar, globalist, World Economic Forum-backed, United States-backed, unipolar order with, you know, one currency, the central bank digital currency. And yeah, so we'll keep our eye on what comes out of this. Watch also how the Western media is covering this over the next 24 to 48 hours. Will you get any sort of fair coverage about it at all? We've kind of outlined a few pieces of propaganda already that you're hearing about it, but we're going to cover it fairly. I mean, we're going to cover exactly what comes out of this meeting and not put any propagandic spin on it here on this show.
Sure. Well, they're probably going to be pretty good negotiations because it looks like it's starting off with a shot of vodka. I don't know if you saw that.
Vodka.
You know.
Did you hear what was it? One of the football players for Russia was saying that like he was, what do you call, the Black Spider or something like that. He plays every game. Before every game, he takes a shot of vodka.
Ooh.
He's like, it loosens up my muscles. It loosens up my muscles.
I don't know about
it
that.
It must loosen up their negotiation muscles.
I mean, it makes you so much slower.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand how that could work. Did you see?
But if Russians have it for breakfast, I'm sure they're like used to it, you know? It's like,
I don't think it works like that.
I don't know. Did I see what?
Never mind. We'll talk about vodka another time.
Now to President Trump. So let's talk about this. Alex Jones, the team at InfoWars, reporting that Trump will surrender to prosecutors this week instead of being arrested. Again, this coming from InfoWars with an exclusive confirming Trump in talks with the New York prosecutor to turn himself in next week. This was over the weekend reporting on this. He'll be fingerprinted, mugshot taken, which will be plastered all over the media. And he will go to prison. Will he get bail? That's the question. Will he be out, be able to post bail? There's a number of reports that say that they will not do that, that the judge in this case would not allow him to be posting bail because, according to reports, he could incite another January 6th, according to these reports. Would be unbelievable. And the question then this afternoon is, would the United States descend into civil war? And that's what we're hearing. Over the past few months, we've heard calls of this. Like if President Trump is arrested, they go after him in this way, that the United States would be ripped in half and descend into civil war. And I don't know. I don't know if I buy that, but what do you think?
Well, I think that if it was like they had legitimate reasons for this, that there would be justification for people getting upset if it were real. But I don't know. They took some felonies and turned them into misdemeanors, and then what they're getting him on is a misdemeanor that was somehow turned into a felony. I don't understand how that happened. So it's like that kind of thing that's going to charge the base. It's like these nefarious little things they're doing. If it was legitimate and they could prove it and they had lots of evidence, I think people would understand.
Yes. You know, I think the thing that brings me any comfort, because I'm afraid of it, not because I'm a fan of President Trump or I think that anybody is against the law, but we have seen above the law, right? But we have seen many types of campaign contributions that have gone unnoticed on one side and are then put under a microscope on another. And both of them should be wrong. The story that we had this morning And out of the New York Times about the Iran-Contra or the Iran hostage crisis and how the Reagan administration sort of asked the government of Iran for the favor of holding the hostages until the election. That is campaign contribution. We see how these things are not so cut and dry and how there may be a political appetite to take this one person down. And that should be scary to everyone, even if you don't like Donald Trump. And I feel very terrified about what it could do to a democracy. And I feel like I feel emotional about it.
I do, too. I'm scared. I'll be honest with you. I think it's a terrifying prospect, regardless of how you feel about Trump. Like, it's not, to me, it's more of like a symbol. It's the symbolism of it right now.
But we should have this idea that, well, then he'll get a trial and the trial would be fair. And those are things that I feel shaky about saying out loud now.
Yeah.
Because we don't see fair trials. We just were looking at the January 6th trials where so many people did not get to present an ample amount of evidence. We should have a confidence in the system that there will be, that he will get his day in court, which was one of the reasons that, one of the things the Bob Mueller investigation really grappled with is, would he ever get a fair trial while he was in office? And now that he's not, will he get a fair trial? And I can't say that with a full confidence, and I would like to.
I can't imagine that we will. We have Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, coming out saying that this judge is crooked and is doing this for political reasons. So you literally have the Speaker of the House slamming the judge in this case. And so, again, he hasn't been arrested as of this moment, but this could happen any moment, and we don't exactly sure when. PJ Media, Robert Spencer at PJ Media, is reporting that it might be a few more days before this happens, as prosecutors are going to be interviewing one more witness this afternoon on Monday. So, you know, we don't know, right? I mean, we could see this, right? PJ Media saying, hold everything. Now Trump will likely not be arrested, at least on Tuesday, according to Robert Spencer. So maybe we'll see this later in the week. I don't know.
I mean, we can hold up many examples. For instance, the Iran hostage crisis that we just spoke about. We can talk about the Hunter Biden laptop story that was suppressed in advance of the Biden election. We can talk about these are all campaign contributions, which is what the argument that was made was, that this is information that the public had a right to that was suppressed in order to benefit one candidate. No one was punished for the Hunter Biden laptop story, and that was arguably a campaign contribution. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, remember also during the Clinton campaign, there was blatant use of her super PAC with the DNC and stuff, and that was like, it was reported, highly reported, and just ignored, and that's illegal as well. So yeah, and they're going to go look at super PACs?
And we learned, a few months ago, we learned that, like, the Hillary Clinton campaign, as it relates to this, the Steele dossier, ended up just paying a fine for, like, creating the Steele dossier. Like, just paid a fine. Really? Oh, so let me just be clear about the double standard here in this, right? Again, regardless of your politics, like, I think both parties are corrupt, Republicans and Democrats. That's why there's 100 million Americans that do not vote for either party, because they recognize both of these parties are corrupt, right? So we know that. But when you know that the office is being used for political reasons to root out and go against political foes, using the FBI in that way, using the Justice Department in that way to go after your foes and to silence them, to block them. And the argument with Trump, too, is that this could be used as a cudgel to keep him from raising any kind of money. Because now, unlike in 2020, now there's other candidates that are going to run. He was the incumbent. Now he's not the incumbent anymore. And so that means that, will the Republican National Committee throw money at a candidate that's risky because he could be behind bars? Or are they going to be able to spread that money around to DeSantis and other people? And this is a strategy that some are saying is being used, not necessarily to actually keep him in prison, but to shake up his money. There, he will not have the war chest that he once had. And this is an effort to undermine a campaign in 2024 against Biden or Democrats by taking his money right out from underneath them in this way.
Yes, or will he become a Lula da Silva and sort of have a Cinderella story, was indicted for something and then now comes back from it in order to make him stronger?
Here's the thing with Trump. I'm just going to say this, guys. I don't think the deep state will not allow him to be president again. They will not allow him to be president. They didn't allow, I think they were absolutely influential. We saw it in the last election with him. They do not want him to be president. They don't want him undermining the Justice Department. They don't want, you know, calling out the Justice Department. They don't want him like ending foreign wars, which he was arguably pushing towards. It was one of the big reasons why they went against him.
Yes.
So I just do not think the deep state wants him. And I'm not saying I'm any kind of Trump supporter. I'm just saying I don't believe that they want him in there. They're going to do everything they can to figure out ways to keep him from getting in.
And the one thing I do feel strongly about is, had Trump stayed in office, we would not have this situation in Ukraine. He was not pushing for NATO expansion.
For sure.
And so for that reason alone is one reason to sort of trip him up.
Hundreds of thousands of people are now dead in Ukraine as a result of this mess. But, you know, he also, Trump, expanded the drone program under that President Obama put in place. So, you know, this is not like
he
a guy that's
assassinated an Iranian general.
Yeah, this is not a guy that's walking on roses. You know, like Trump is like, you know, showering with rose petals falling all over him. Like he's the peacemaker. No, he's done, like there's plenty of, if you're anti-war, then you're not celebrating the guy in that way, right? But to your point
about
Ukraine, this wouldn't have happened.
He just did a speech, and I did a video on it, that he's calling for a federal stop and frisk for police officers. That's a blatant violation of the Fourth Amendment. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons people should be like looking at this guy. But you're right, he did do a lot of things that were good. But also remember when he said something about locking Hillary Clinton up, that was like a media hellfire storm for saying it.
Yeah.
And now you actually have a side going after a president.
But you remember when he was president, when they asked him about Hillary Clinton, the email server and all of that, and what he said in response, like, do you still want her locked up? And he's like, let it go. Like, mm-hmm. Don't go after her. Like, don't use the we're not going to have, like, put our Justice Department, yeah, like, on it, like, going after her, like, viciously. Like, we got it. Like, let's move on. Like, right. That was his response to it.
Yeah.
Quite a different time now at the Justice Department. I just want to say this because, you know, Michael Cohen was on the Al Sharpton show. I mean, there's something slimy about watching anything that Al Sharpton does, including this. I mean, he interviewed Trump's old attorney, convicted felon, Michael Cohen, who says the evidence is irrefutable that Trump broke the law. Now, of course, he has absolute axe to grind here, right? Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to 3 years. He only ended up serving like a year because of the COVID pandemic. They let him out. He wrote a book called Revenge. So you know where he's coming from on
this. Sure.
But the point is, he says the evidence he sees is irrefutable. But then you have Michael Avenatti, who was Stormy Daniels' attorney, who's now behind bars, says that he thinks this case against Trump is incredibly flimsy. So literally,
and he's the one who brought it.
He's the one who brought it. That's literally Stormy Daniels' like attorney. He's now behind bars. The whole thing feels dirty, right? But here you have Michael Avenatti saying that this thing is flimsy. Michael Cohen saying it's irrefutable. So, wow. I know, it's just crazy. I need a shower after seeing these guys.
Do you know how it went from a misdemeanor to a felony? Does anybody know how that happened? Did you read that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. And we don't even know what the charges are. Like, we're just still all waiting to find out exactly what is the indictment. We don't even know what the indictment. So any sort of speaking about it right now is all hypothetical.
Well, he was named as Person A, I believe, in Michael Cohen's indictment. Which I recall, which again had to do with the checks, how the checks were written,
right,
and how it was kept and how it was like communicated in order to keep it from the press.
Yeah. So hiding it as a hush money payment, hiding it. Do the American people have a right to know that this money is part of a campaign contribution or part of a campaign? The American people should have had a right to know that this hush money was paid to Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
In the same way that, in the same way that we should have known about a Hunter Biden laptop that was kept from us.
Right.
It was suppressed.
Which we've seen the emails now from the FBI to Twitter for why to do it. That arguably is a campaign finance contribution.
So let me just wrap it up with this point on the Civil War issue, right? It's a real interesting moment. Like the President of the United States gets indicted, arguably arrested, gets mugshots taken. What happens? Like, what do you guys think happens? Do you think that this country is ripped apart? along class lines? I mean, is that what we're going to see, or is it going to be states? Like, we're going to see fire in the streets in Republican states, or I don't know. I can't wrap my head around how exactly it's not going to look like the 1961 or 1861 Civil War, you know, Mason-Dixon line. Like, you know, you're not going to see a civil war in that way. So what will it happen in neighborhood and neighborhood across the country? Right. Is that what's going to happen? People are going to rise up, or have they moved on beyond this and they're kind of sick of the show?
I don't know. Ideally we get a trial, but even if we do get a trial and it's sort of presented in a fair way, there's no way we're all going to agree on what's fair and what's, what do you think, Philip?
Oh, I mean, maybe I'm just being an optimist, but like what I hope comes of it is it sets a precedence where we start jailing corrupt politicians and then we just keep right on going. Because, I mean, ultimately that has to happen. Yeah, until like basically, yeah. And it just like all of the incumbents. I mean, you could probably find something indictable on almost every person in Congress.
Yeah, it'd be
There's
great.
Too much corruption.
It'd be great if we could just clean house with all of these
all
people.
All of them.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and not just, you know, not just start with Trump, but literally go through the entire West Wing and go through Congress and, you know, start with Nancy Pelosi and her stock, you know, her stock tips and, you know,
the Biden Chinese money story that came out over the weekend, which was complicated, and we sort of went through it in the newsletter on Friday. There's plenty here. It cannot be just one side that's held their feet to the fire.
Yeah.
You know, what happened here is not right. The American public did have a right to know about this, although arguably it was just after the Access Hollywood tape, so no one would have been surprised by it, and he may not have changed the outcome of the election. In the same way we had the right to know about the Hunter Biden laptop story, in the same way that the Iranian hostages should have been negotiated on Jimmy Carter's watch. There's plenty of this to go around. And to, you know, so yeah, sure. Let's hold them all to you know, account. But we absolutely should, it should give us a renewed faith in our legal system as well, if we are able to see a fair trial and see, you know, people on the left held to similar standards.
Let us know your thoughts on this in the comments below. We've got more news to get to here on your Monday. Colonel Douglas McGregor is going to join us around the gathering storm in Ukraine. The United States can't even produce ammunition. How the hell are we going to continue to push for continued war in Ukraine? The colonel has just written a great new piece on basically the collapsing West. We're going to talk to him about that. We're also going to look at the latest on the Twitter files and why is Israel on fire? The protests, thousands upon thousands of people in the streets of Tel Aviv protesting Benjamin Netanyahu. What will happen there? There's calls for former president of Israel saying, that there's civil war coming to Israel. So there's a lot of civil war talk happening around the world today. We'll get there. But hey, it's the first day of spring, so we have to be at least a little bit encouraged, right? This was my favorite time of year, one of my favorite times of year, because I mowed lawns for a living. I used to mow a lot of lawns in Reading, Pennsylvania, on a crew with like six or seven guys, and go out and mowing lawns like crazy, starting in April when I would get out of college and come back for the spring and into the summer, all summer long mowing lawns. And guess what? I love when the weather starts warming up, getting out in my yard, digging in my garden. It's one of my favorite parts of the spring. And Sunday Lawn Care makes it easier than ever to enjoy. If you're like me, you love spring, but you may not love figuring out how to take care of your yard. What fertilizer do I use? Why am I getting crabgrass? Like, what the heck is going on with all these clovers in my yard? What is happening? If you're wondering where to start, that's where Sunday Lawn Care comes in. Sunday is everything you need to get the lawn you've dreamed of. This spring, all you need to do is go to getsunday.com/redacted. Getsunday.com/redacted. Enter your address and you'll get a customized plan for your own area based on your climate and your zip code. So just try it out. And you'll get a customized approach for your lawn. No trips to the store, hauling heavy bags, since they will ship straight to your home. You just need a hose. All you need to hook up your hose, and they'll send you the Sunday bag. And you fertilize your whole lawn in less time than it takes to watch an episode of your favorite TV show. It's that easy. They use only ingredients that you can feel good about. No harsh chemicals, no long waiting periods, or trying to keep your kids and pets off the lawn. Simply add, you let it dry, and you're back to enjoying your yard. Sunday is easy and affordable. Some lawn care services cost more than $1,500 a year, But Sunday's full season plan starts at just $109. So Sunday is offering our listeners right now 20% off. Full season plans start at just $109. You can get your 20% off when you visit get, you have to put in the get there, getsunday.com/redacted at checkout. That's 20% off your custom plan at getsunday.com/redacted. Well, to listen to the mainstream media talk about Ukraine, the massive Ukrainian spring offensive is unfolding. Yet there are a lot of concerns that America can't handle any of that right now. Colonel Douglas McGregor has just written a fantastic new piece called The Gathering Storm, How the Crisis of American National Power Has Begun. It's a great piece. I encourage you all to read it. We will link it up in the description below. But you're also lucky because we have the colonel himself right now to dive deeper into this story. Colonel, welcome back to the show.
Good to see you, Clayton.
So what was the impetus for this piece?
I think the convergence of a number of different crises all at once. On the one hand, you have the obvious banking crisis that is just beginning now, which is likely to be much worse than the 2008 financial crisis. In fact, this morning I was reading about the top 15 banks in the United States that are likely to fail next. And of those, three have been identified as coming quite shortly. The question is, what are we going to do about this? And that's a question I can't answer. My great fear is that the administration will simply print money, in which case inflation will worsen, and then we'll all be poor because our currency will be worth nothing. I hope that doesn't happen. But it's a very serious problem, and the administration has to deal with it one way or the other. At the same time, you've got the problem in Europe. Europeans are increasingly restless. In Germany, people are furious. This news of the Nord Pole destruction has finally made its way into the population. They've got a huge wave of Ukrainian refugees they're dealing with, plus the Muslim migrants that they've got on their hands since 2015. There's a lot of discontent in Germany. It's not just Germany, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, France, all the countries in Western Europe are unhappy. Nobody is interested in this war against Russia. And here we are trying desperately to drag all of them in any way that we can into this fight. And this fight is a fight that we are very definitely losing. And you know what Washington does when it's not winning? It lies and tells everyone they are winning. And that's what's going on right now in Ukraine.
Well, what do you make of the lies then? You hear, you know, we've been hearing from the mainstream media that Ukraine is about to launch this large offensive. Of course, we've been hearing that Russia is going to launch their offensive. So what's the truth here? And then as you point out in this piece, you said the growing realization that America and European military industrial capacity cannot keep up with Ukrainian demands for ammunition and equipment is an ominous signal to send during a proxy war that Washington insists its Ukrainian surrogate is winning. So we're saying that Ukraine's winning. And yet you're pointing out the realization that we can't even sustain the ammunition needed for them to fake win this war.
Yeah, I mean, the Ukrainians have obliged the Russians by pouring tens of thousands of troops in eastern Ukraine into offensives over the last several months, attack after attack after attack. This started long before the fall in last year, and they've lost tens of thousands of people. The most recent figures that I've seen, and they're very, very credible, suggest that there were up to about 250,000 dead Ukrainians. I mean, that's a horrific number for a war that's only been going on for about a year. So how do you build new armies? I mean, there's some evidence that you've had three armies literally fielded in the time that this war has taken place. The first, of course, was this professional force of about 450,000 with about 200,000 reservists. That was largely destroyed in the first 6 months. Then a second force was raised for mobilization. That force was destroyed in the fall, and then a third mobilization began before Christmas. And right now it looks as though these brigades that entered with, say, 2,000 soldiers or 2,500 soldiers are down to about 100 or 200 effectives. And the numbers of wounded, 300,000 or 400,000, consist of people who will never return to duty. So the question is, what will the Ukrainians do next? And it seems that they've decided they're going to scrape together whatever they can find and once again throw it into the offensive on the assumption that if they do not attack, people will discover that they can't win. The Russians, of course, are in no hurry. They have fought the Ukrainians with a fraction of their force. You've got maybe 80 to 100,000 Russians who are killing successive waves of Ukrainian attacks, backed by enormous artillery power, rockets, missiles, drones. I mean, this is warfare on the scale of World War I. And the Ukrainians, unfortunately, are doing all the wrong things and bleeding themselves to death. So I don't think this can continue indefinitely. And I think people in Washington know the truth, even though nobody wants to tell it. Everyone continues to maintain the fiction that Ukraine is doing well and can ultimately win, that the Russians are incompetent, stupid, and can't do anything. It's all nonsense. I mean, just this morning, I read the final tallies coming in from credible sources that the Russian integrated air defenses have shot down 402 jets, 256 helicopters,
whoa,
thousands and thousands of unmanned aircraft, or what we call drones. So the integrated Russian air defenses have turned out to be extremely lethal and very, very effective. This war is not going well for the West. And I think President Biden and his immediate advisors do know that. The question is, how do they disengage? And that's really why I wrote this piece.
And so you're hearing, I imagine, from your sources in Washington, that there is this maybe movement towards wanting to get out of this thing.
Yes.
How much resolve do you think there is for that?
You know, it's hard to tell. First of all, I hate to be blunt, but I no longer pay much attention to what the cardboard cutout called Biden says. I really don't think he's in charge. I think he's handed things to read, and he reads them and says them in a convincing way, by the way, that we should not underestimate.
Yeah.
But I don't think he's in charge. But there are others who are unappointed, unelected. Some are appointed, most are not. But the key thing is none of them are elected, and they're running the government. You have the diehards led by Nuland and her band of so-called neocons, with Blinken in trail and Austin in trail and so forth. They're not going to quit. They will go to the last Ukrainian if it's necessary. But there are others who are saying, wait a minute, is this really what we want to happen? It's clear that Scholz is in a lot of trouble in Germany. He came here to see Biden to tell him how much trouble he is in. One of the oldest metal firms in Germany, founded in 1380, a firm that survived from 1380 through the two world wars into the present, has just declared bankruptcy and gone under in Germany.
Wow.
And the reason is very simple. No energy.
Right.
And you have to have quantities of cheap energy to maintain your scientific industrial base. Germany is dying in that sense. The German population is furious. You can't keep this up. So how do we get out? And that's an important question. And at some point, the only way to get out is to turn to the Russians and say, no preconditions, let's talk. And I don't think that we're going to be very happy with what the Russians ultimately say privately in terms of what their conditions are for an end to the war, because we will have lost everything we set out to win.
Well, the numbers you just dropped on me are pretty astonishing. I hope our audience was paying attention to that too, on the upwards of 400 jets and thousands of unmanned aerial vehicles, and you name it. I mean, the list is endless. And most of those coming from the West, or were those Ukrainian jets? What do they have left at this point? We know the Poles are now sending in, they're proud of the fact that they're going to send in some jets for the first time. A bunch of United States congressmen are coming together saying we need to send jets to Ukraine from the United States, just throwing more weapons into a black hole.
Well, those are the wrong weapons, given the lethality of air defenses. And I think we're seeing the future is here, if you will. I don't want to say we're seeing the future. The future is upon us. And it is a future in which manned aircraft and even unmanned aircraft are going to be at very high risk in any war, if the opponent has the kind of air defense technology and radar arrays that the Russians have. The Russians, of course, came out of World War II with the understanding that they needed integrated, overlapping air defenses. We never came out of the war that way. We came out of the war with the assumption that if we build enough fighter aircraft, we can defeat anybody. Well, that's changed. And those aircraft were flown by Ukrainians, and they were all lost. The same thing with helicopters. Now, the Russians have lost some too, but a fraction of what the Ukrainians have lost. And the Russians do have the ability right now to launch close air support missions, because there's nothing up there to stop them. And the Ukrainian air defenses have been largely demolished. All of these missile attacks that you've heard about week after week after week have been aimed at very specific targets. They have not been aimed at the civilian populations. They've been aimed at stripping away and destroying any air defense capability that exists in Ukraine, number one. Number two, aimed at the energy grids, the transfer of power, stopping the rail lines, stopping heating, all these kinds of things, making life obviously miserable. Those have been the top priority targets, and then command and control and all the usual military targets. It's all worked. And the Russians have built up their forces right now to a point where they're ready to go. The point is that they didn't go in January because the ground simply did not freeze enough. Remember, we've got 10 to 15 feet of black earth in eastern Ukraine. I mean, this black earth is wonderful stuff. It's so fertile. I mean, a Russian told me one day, just stick a stone and a log into it and stuff grows. It's that fertile. During World War II, the Germans loaded up rail cars with the black earth and shipped it back to Germany to improve the fertility of German soil. I mean, this is some of the most fertile territory in the entire world. The problem is it's 10 to 15 feet, some places even deeper. You drive off the road now and you sink like a rock into mud. It has to dry out. So what the Russians have been doing is essentially inviting the Ukrainians into what they call fire traps. By all means, attack in Bakhmut. Just march on in there with thousands of men, and then we'll annihilate you in an encirclement. But they always leave a road open so that the few survivors can get out, or if they're stupid enough, they'll send in more soldiers. Ukrainians continue to send in more soldiers. Now, Bakhmut is important as a logistical hub, a rail hub, for all sorts of reasons. This is the last remnant of the Ukrainian defense of the Donbas, what we used to call the Donetsk Basin. That's quite clear. And if they lose that, then they're effectively, they've got behind them nothing but rolling open terrain all the way up to the river and Kiev. So they'll have to fall back. They know that. They want to hold on to this, understand, but it's cost them far too many lives. And at some point, you have to do what the Russians did early in the war. Remember, we had this, had all these claims of Ukrainian victory around Kharkov. Look, the Ukrainians advanced 100 kilometers and the Russians put up no resistance. Well, that wasn't entirely true, but the Russians decided it was just open, flat terrain of no real strategic value. They could win it back later. So they said, we'll economize, pull those forces out, and we'll use them where we can defend more easily. The same thing down at Kherson. Those weren't defeats. Those were deliberate decisions to give up ground that was of no value. And the point is that the Russians are currently sitting on the territory that produces 90% of Ukrainian GNP. There's no hurry right now. Right. Let the Ukrainians defend themselves. And at some point, probably in May or June, when the ground really dries out, because they're still having rains out there in eastern and southern Ukraine, when it dries out, they'll move. And I was trying to get people to understand, why are we waiting for this inevitable hammer to fall? The Ukrainians are in desperate conditions, desperate shape. Let's have talks now and rescue what we can. But I think it's a big struggle inside the administration and on the Hill. And you have people like Lindsey Graham saying, oh, no, let's shoot down Russian aircraft. Let's right. widen the war. Let's kill more people. Yeah. Rubio is right there with him.
Yeah, they are bloodthirsty, and they'll throw whatever they can at the wall right now. Let's go to war with China. Let's go into Mexico. Let's invade Mexico. Let's attack Russia head on. So I'll get you out of here on this, which is that drone that was, there's still a mystery about exactly how it went down. I've spoken to Marine Corps pilots who just say the whole thing smells weird about how that drone went down. Doesn't make any sense, even though the footage is there. So the response on that, I mean, that whole incident, the fact that the DOD comes out with that footage a day later, there's something going on here. What do you make of this drone footage and the Biden administration's response to it, and frankly, the Russians' response to it?
Well, remember in 2019, we very nearly went to war with Iran. And General McKenzie in CENTCOM had requested a Global Hawk, which is an unmanned aircraft that carries a substantial ISR package. He said he wanted to use it in U.S. Central Command. It ultimately was sent to him from Guam. He took it, employed it, and they sketched out a flight path right up through the center of the Straits of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf, which skirted what we call the Air Defense Identification Zone. It was a military reconnaissance aircraft, and the Iranians ultimately shot it down. Now, if you look at international law, any military aircraft that is on the edge of your air defense identification zone that does not identify itself as friendly and explain what it's doing can be shot down illegally. And that's what happened. Then suddenly there was this tremendous pressure on President Trump, largely from Bolton and McKenzie and Pompeo and others. We need to strike back at the Iranians and punish them for this. They can't do this to us. They're challenging our power. Fortunately, you know, Donald Trump said, no, thank you. He asked, did we lose anyone? They said, no. Well, if we didn't lose anyone, I'm disinclined to harm or kill Iranians and begin a new war. And so it stopped. But at the time, Bolton and McKenzie and others had put together a strike package ready to go.
Of course.
This looks to me like a similar phenomenon where everyone knows there is an exclusion zone over Crimea. In other words, if you fly close to Crimea, you sail close to Crimea with your intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets, the Russians are going to warn you off. What nobody bothered to tell anyone is that the Russians warned us off. They detected the aircraft, even though its transponders were off. I guess it was in broad daylight, so it wasn't hard. And they warned us, and jets flew up there and flew past it several times, again, warning us off, warning us off, warning us off. There was no answer, so finally they managed to down it. I don't know how that happened. Like you, I really don't know. And I do agree that having looked at this video, it looks fishy. But having said all of that, the important thing is we haven't really reacted very much to this. In other words, we did not demand an apology from Moscow. We did not threaten counterstrikes. We simply have told Americans that we will continue our mission, woof, woof, woof. But the truth is, I don't think we're going to challenge Russian airspace over Crimea again, or anywhere else for that matter. So my read on this thing is the administration is reconsidering what it's been doing. There's a big fight between the radical neocon leftists, globalists, on one hand, and then the rest of the administration that says, look, we've got all these problems inside the United States now. What are we going to do about it? And I don't have an answer for them, but they're going to have to deal with this financial crisis because, Clayton, as you pointed out in some of your presentations long before this, this is much worse than anything we faced in 2008.
Right. Yeah. And the bailout now in account, adjusted for inflation is much larger than 2008. And the housing crisis we haven't even spoke about is on the brink. So we've got a lot of problems at home. And imagine if this was in the Gulf of Mexico.
And if we try to bail out the millionaires and billionaires, we'll debase our currency. We'll destroy it. Because the only way to do that is to print money.
Now, I think you're right about the response, because I think they were hoping for a much larger response from the American people. Like, how dare Russia shoot down? But it seemed like, from what I gathered online and other, and, you know, anecdotally at least, people were a little bit more circumspect, saying, well, why are we there? If they did this in the Gulf of Mexico, how would we respond? That was a lot of the response I saw. And I don't think the Biden administration was expecting that, or the neocons were expecting that.
Wait, I think you're 100% right. And then, of course, you have the New York Times and the Washington Post over the last 72, 96 hours who printed articles where the truth is hidden in the articles. Ukrainians are exhausted. They've suffered horrific losses. You know, it paints a very grim picture. And I think there's also a movement to sort of gradually condition Americans to the inevitability of the Ukraine's loss in the hopes that it will soften the blow when it finally comes. My concern is with this radical fringe that has really been running the show in the administration. These are your radical globalists. The radicals are trying to force CRT down our throats here at home, that want to keep the borders open, that are trying to perpetuate rather than shut down criminality in our cities. These are the same people that are happy to commit us to an all-out war with Russia. These people have to be brought under control. They're not Democrats, you know. Right. And I don't think Rubio and Lindsey Graham, frankly, qualify as Republicans. That's a lot of nonsense. Historically, Republicans have not stood for any of this warmongering. So we're in a lot of trouble in Washington. And the good news is that DeSantis at least had the common sense to say, no, it is not a vital strategic interest of the United States to become involved in eastern Ukraine. Trump has said that for a very long time. Trump was always opposed to any conflict of any kind with Russia or China because it's not necessary. If you want to fight a war on the economic level, in other words, not a war, but you're conflicted, then you can do what Trump wanted to do with China. Don't trade with them.
Right.
If you can't trade on an equitable basis, don't trade. Sounds reasonable to me. But this unrelenting war against Russia on every level, economic, financial, military, it's very dangerous. And the Russians are mobilized. They're ready to fight. We're not ready to fight anyone. Let's be frank. We can't even recruit for the armed forces.
That's incredibly troubling. And you're absolutely right about the recruitment numbers. Well, Colonel, I want to get you out of here on a respectable time. I want everyone to go read the article. It's a great piece called The Gathering Storm. We'll have it linked up in the description below. A great piece from Colonel Douglas McGregor. Colonel, great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Clayton. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, Colonel. We really appreciate it. And I will have a link to the Colonel's piece called The Gathering Storm. It'll be in the show description if you want to go and read it. It's a really good piece. And the fact that we can't produce ammunition and the decline of the West in the midst of all of this banking collapse, it's a really important piece. So encourage all of you to go read the Colonel's piece.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about many things, protests in Israel and the Twitter files. But first, I want to tell you about our friends over at stamps.com. Now, you may be thinking about going to the post office to file. What is it? What time of year is it? Tax time.
Taxes.
Are you excited about this? Oh. Well, it's exciting to have it done. It's not exciting to go to the post office. You probably already know that. But with stamps.com, you can print your own postage and shipping labels right from your home or office, and it's ready to go in minutes, so you can get back up and running to your business sooner. Now, of course, it's not just for taxes, but for other things that you may want to ship for your business, such as redacted t-shirts, if you were doing something like that, mugs, let's see, whatever it is you're selling on Etsy. Of course, this is the post office elevated. Postage rates just increased again, but luckily stamps.com has the best discounts in the industry with rates that you literally can't find anywhere else, like up to 84% off USPS and UPS. Plus, stamps.com automatically tells you your cheapest and fastest shipping options. They are a one-stop shop for all of your shipping and mailing needs. For 25 years, stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses. So set your business up for success when you get started with stamps.com today. Sign up with a promo code redacted for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click that microphone at the top of the page, and enter the code redacted. Once again, that's stamps.com/redacted and use our code redacted. And thank you again to stamps.com for sponsoring our show.
Well, here's something you don't hear every day. Civil war in Israel. Well, that's the latest headline from the Jerusalem Post. Take a look. One of the country's biggest newspapers, Israel's president Isaac Herzog saying Israel is at the edge of an abyss. Is the U.S.'s top ally in the Middle East really about to implode? Or is this a lot of talk from liberal elites in that country? Our correspondent in Washington, Dan Cohen, spent years covering Israel-Palestine from that region, is going to help us understand all of this from Washington today. Dan, good to see you. So, civil war in Israel?
Well, I got to say, it's an incredibly rich statement from Isaac Herzog, and he's the president of Israel, which I want to clarify is essentially a ceremonial position. So he's not a very powerful figure. The prime minister is Benjamin Netanyahu. So president does not mean the same thing in Israel as it does in the United States, for example. So I want to give a little context so we can understand what's going on here. So tens, even hundreds of thousands of Israelis have been going out into the street in and protesting since January, and they're protesting against a bill that proposes judicial reforms that will basically severely weaken the Supreme Court and consolidate power in the Knesset, which is Israel's parliament, and is now dominated by the hard right wing, and religious coalition of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So the bill has already passed an initial vote and has to pass two more to become law. And Israel doesn't have a constitution, so there are really no rights guaranteed, even to Jewish Israelis, by law. Netanyahu's government is the most right-wing and religious and in Israeli history for the nth time. And most notably among its lawmakers is a figure named Itamar Ben-Gvir, who was a member of organizations and parties that even the Israeli government considered terrorist groups. So now he's in power. He's actually the internal security minister, the guy in charge of the police throughout the entire country. He's really part of an overall rise of the ultra-right that has been decades in the making. You also have a figure named Bezalel Smotrich, who is just in the U.S. this past week making the rounds with Israel lobby groups, and he has been protested by liberal Jewish groups. So the right wing in Israel has long sought to get rid of the Supreme Court, which it sees as a barrier to advancing its agenda. Right wing politicians have often spoken about actually taking a bulldozer to the Supreme Court itself. Moti Yogev back in 2015, who was part of the Jewish Home Party, along with Bezalel Smotrich, openly said it and refused to apologize. But I spoke to the Canadian-Israeli journalist David Sheen about what he says are the three factors behind this effort to weaken the Supreme Court.
We can say that there are three factors driving the efforts by the new Netanyahu government to alter the balance of power in Israel and to neuter the judiciary. One is the fact that Netanyahu himself is up on corruption charges, as have been other members of his government. And he's hoping that by changing and reducing the powers of the judiciary, then he can prevent it from disqualifying him and other ministers who are up on corruption charges from running for office. That's number one. Number two is the fact that this government wants to pass racist legislation, lots of it. And over the years, of course, Israeli governments successively have passed many laws that are racist to Palestinians and other non-Jewish groups. Most of the time they passed without judicial oversight. Occasionally, there were instances in which the High Court put a stop to it and said, no, this is just too far. You're going to have to take it back to the legislature and rewrite it. And because of that, because they've impeded the speed by which the Knesset, Israel's parliament, has passed racist laws, they want to neuter the judiciary. And the third factor is that the religious parties want to change Israel's form of government entirely from a Jewish ethnocracy in which rights and privileges are accorded to people based on their ethnicity. So if you're a Jew by birth, then you have more rights than a non-Jew by birth in Israel. So they want to change that ethnocracy into a Jewish theocracy in which rights are accorded based on the laws of the Torah and the Talmud and everything that would imply.
So just to expand on what David said a little bit, Netanyahu has been facing numerous corruption charges for a variety of issues, and he brought in the ultra-right. He built this coalition in order to get himself legal immunity, which is done through this judicial move. So then you have another political current, which is kind of difficult to separate, but that wants to impose even more restrictive and discriminatory laws on minorities living inside Israel, whether Palestinians or African asylum seekers or whatever else. And then you have religious parties that want a total theocratic state, as David said. They want the rule of the rabbis rather than any kind of any semblance of democratic rule. So the protesters, the people who have been going out in the streets, are the liberal class who want to have it both ways. They want a Jewish state that affords them rights and privileges over basically half the population or more of Palestinians who are living under occupation in the West Bank, living under siege in the Gaza Strip. They want to go to cafes in Tel Aviv and West Jerusalem and not really see Palestinians. As David calls it, they want to live in an ethnocracy where they're afforded rights and privileges based on their ethnicity. But they want to be free to live secular lives like they're in Western Europe, they're in Paris or London. So this system of a Jewish state, the concept of Zionism that privileges their ethnic groups over others, breeds this intense religious nationalism that has now come to power through Netanyahu and is pushing the effort to neuter the Supreme Court. So Isaac Herzog, who was quoted in the Jerusalem Post, Clayton, that you said at the beginning, this headline about civil war is the perfect embodiment of this kind of hypocrisy. He led Israel's Labor Party for many years. The Labor Party was the it dominated Israeli politics for the first three decades of the country's existence, from the late 40s, 50s, 60s, all the way to the late 70s. And it was in power in the 1990s too. It created the ultra-nationalist settlement enterprise and what it denounces as extremists today that are threatening democracy. So Herzog, Isaac Herzog, the president who's saying we're on the verge of civil war, in 2021, November of 2021, he went to the city of Hebron in the occupied West Bank, a Palestinian city where a tiny number of fanatical settlers live in the heart of the old city. If you ever go there, it is just a jarring sight of separation, of military occupation. And he goes to this mosque called the Ibrahimi Mosque, where in 1993, an American-Israeli settler went and opened fire on men and boys in the middle of prayer, called the Ibrahimi Mosque Massacre, killed 29 men and boys and injured like more than 100 more. And this guy is considered a hero to the ultra-right wing and those settlers that he's denouncing. So Herzog went to an actual Hanukkah candle lighting ceremony with these people, with this ultra fanatical political current who he says are destroying Israel today. So when it comes to kind of maintaining the system of supremacy and occupation over Palestinians, they're all on the same page. When it comes to internal issues in Israeli society, they're shocked and appalled.
I wanted to get your take on this, which is protesters in Israel are calling on a lobbying group from the United States. And if I'm wrong on this, tell me I'm wrong, but AIPAC, which is one of the largest pro-Israel lobbying groups in the United States, and you see Israeli protesters calling on AIPAC to come in and help them. Let's watch.
Everybody out there, we're heading for dark times. AIPAC, we need you. We need you with us.
AIPAC, you've supported Israel through all our wars. This is a war for Israel's future.
We are in a critical moment now. It's about time that Howard Kaur will raise his voice, not just behind the screen, because we're on the edge.
We ask of the representatives from AIPAC here today to tell our Prime Minister that they believe Israel should stay a strong democracy as it is today.
You cannot be quiet. Please help us. Let's do it together.
So I've never heard of something like this before. You have protests, you know, in a country and they're calling on a foreign lobbying group to intervene. What's going on here?
Yeah, so AIPAC to the rescue. It's pretty remarkable. So AIPAC is the American-Israel Political Action Committee, the chief organ of what is known as the Israel Lobby, one of the most powerful lobbies in the United States, maybe behind the NRA, Big Pharma, right up there. Okay, so it meddles in U.S. politics. There's an incredible film that Al Jazeera Investigations did showing how the Israel Lobby meddles in the United States with both parties, to the point where it can even destroy candidates who kind of, you know, don't go along with the program. So it's really sort of the umbilical cord that keeps total U.S. support for Israel and keeps it on this permanent trajectory of right-wing ultra-nationalism, military occupation that has resulted in this Netanyahu government. But these protesters don't say anything about the fact that Palestinians are living under the boot of occupation in the West Bank. They don't say anything about the raids in Jenin that we covered. They don't say anything about the siege of the Gaza Strip. So they're perfectly comfortable and happy with that situation, but they're living in this gigantic cognitive dissonance, and these displays of AIPAC save us are the kind of perfect display of liberal elite mentality that, you know, reminds me a lot of kind of coastal liberal elites in the US who all venerated the FBI and the CIA when Trump was elected, because they thought, you know, the establishment that essentially created the conditions for someone like Trump, or in the Israeli case, this new Netanyahu government, is going to be the salvation.
It really is. It sounds that way, right? It sounds like the elites who live in the Tel Aviv skyscrapers really do not like Netanyahu. They don't like, of course, this judicial bill. They don't like that he's got three open court cases, and this looks like he's trying to cover some sort of tracks here, and they're looking at for any excuse they can. They don't like his popularity among the masses, and it very much seems, correct me if I'm wrong, but the hatred that liberals have towards Trump.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a really good comparison. You know, just the fact that, I mean, what you said is popularity among the masses. It's true. He says things that liberals don't want to say. You know, and it's the parallels are spot on. And I'm not a fan of Netanyahu at all, if that's not obvious. But he has a very sharp way of working in politics, of speaking to the masses, of getting them on his side, and, you know, pretending to not play the political game that, you know, liberal elites see as kind of a threat. And he has numerous corruption cases, so they want to take him out for that. They want to kind of go back to the way it was not that long ago, rather than, you know, live under this government that is fervently ultra-nationalist and is also religious and is, you know, wants to impose, you know, theocratic rule to some degree, which frankly Palestinians live under anyway, and they don't want that. They want to, you know, have it both ways.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll continue to watch this, see if what these words about civil war come to pass or not, or more bluster. Dan Cohen, reporting from Washington. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thanks, Clayton.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate that. And we've got more news to get to here. We're going to talk about the latest on the Twitter files, the censorship, and the deeper dive on that, the true stories. If you were wondering, where were all the true stories about the COVID vaccine? Well, they were suppressed. And we'll tell you exactly how all of that unfolded with the latest batch of the Twitter files. But before we're going to do that, we're going to move over to Rumble, because there's a lot of things we're going to talk about in these Twitter files that we really can't talk about on YouTube. Still, unfortunately, the censorship is still very strong with this one on YouTube. So come on over to our Rumble channel, which is rumble.com/redacted. Come on over and subscribe. I think we're nearing 300,000 subscribers on Rumble, which is super exciting.
Very exciting. Yep. And if you hadn't noticed before, can you look over my shoulder here? Take my single shot at our nice Rumble.
There's our Rumble Award.
Yeah, take a look at our Rumble Award right there. We're very proud of it. So thank you for joining us on Rumble and earning us that pretty little trophy. It's very exciting because we don't get trophies, as adults these days.
No, we don't get participation trophies. We actually have to participate and do well. And our channel has done very, very well. Cool. So thank you.
And just think of this. We've got two, I believe, coming from YouTube, but they won't send them to us because we have strikes on our channel.
Community strikes.
Yeah, this is amazing. Yeah. So David brings up a point, right? We hit 1 million subscribers. We would have gotten a nice award from YouTube on that. No, we don't get it. And the reason we don't get it is because we got a community strike for covering COVID stories and literally banned and blocked. So they won't send us our award because of their garbage terms of service. Like, that's hilarious, right? And we should have two. We should actually have two awards coming to us, but we didn't, you know, anyway, we're not
kidding. Wait.
We'll wait. We'll wait till you get your act together. We are proven right anyway. Anyway, so come on over to Rumble right now. It's rumble.com/redacted, rumble.com/redacted. We're going to say goodbye to our YouTube audience. Much love to all of you guys. We'll see you back here tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern time. But the live stream continues right now.